Hi, buddy. My name's John Good, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. Because of God's love, the book Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, I've been sober since April 4th of 1986, and I'm really grateful about that. You guys did a great job. They're over here worried, scared to death. I said, I'll trade places with any one of you over there, you know. German, you did a great job. German, I met German last night, and got a chance to just talk with him for a little bit, and then I met him again this morning, and we kind of went out to a little clubhouse out on Hauser Street and saw a little bit of the country, and my friend Conesville Bob was out there, and him to just had a wonderful time this morning, just a wonderful time. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Johnny for inviting me to come down here and speak. It's always an honor and privilege to get to be and do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you, a little bit about why that's so important for me today. But I want to thank the committee, and this has been a wonderful roundup. And guys, I've just had a ball, and I want to thank you also for welcoming my wife and hosting us, and I brought my little daughter, my oldest daughter, here this weekend, and this is the first time that she's got to experience anything like this out of town, and she's growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and just to have her with me this weekend has just been a blessing, and you haven't figured it out yet. I'm a little emotional, and I got mine. I don't know if you got yours, but I got mine, and let me tell you, that's the way it is for me today, and I don't hide the fact that I do that, and I tell all the guys that I sponsor that it's okay if they do it, because I'll tell you, for a long time, I didn't do that. I covered that up from you, and I kept that from you, and that was one of the secrets that I was scared and emotional and a little kid, and today I don't have to be that way, and heck, I cry at commercials. If you want somebody to cry at your wedding, that's me. You know, if you want somebody to cry when you talk, that's me, you know, and stuff. It's all about the transformation. It's all about the change. It's all about Alcoholics Anonymous. And the speakers this weekend have been just, you know, gosh, fantastic. Bob gave a great talk on Friday night, and we were here to hear Pat talk yesterday afternoon, and she talked about something that's near and dear to me. She talked about recovery and the program. Al-Anon was a big part of our recovery and our program in our house for a while, and I love the program of Al-Anon. Now, the only thing I'm going to say about Al-Anon is it doesn't help you recover from alcoholism, but it kept my wife around long enough that she found AA, and I'm grateful for that. Last night Cliff talked about having fun, and I like that, and we've got to hear Cliff a little bit. The thing I identified with Cliff last night about it that absolutely just triggered me last night, and I thought about it again this morning, was that 8-minute period he's talking about. You know, he drank for 40 minutes, and then he had that 8-minute period when everything was okay. As I tell my story, you're going to find, and it's just all retrospect like they talked about, but it's an amazing thing for me that after a little bit of drinking and after a little bit of time that I became okay. And then, you know, that's what alcohol did for me, and then what I'm going to tell you is what it did to me then. And I'm so grateful that I found you good people. I like your banner. I like Stick with the Winners. I go to a meeting Sunday morning at 9:30 at a place called the White House in Des Moines. It's called the Winners Meeting. And they got a little conference going on down there. It's the 57th annual. And today, right about now, my grand sponsor is chairing a meeting down there. He's 39 years sober and active in Alcoholics Anonymous. This afternoon, there's going to be a couple guys that one's got 51 years and one's got 53 years, and they're going to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous at that place, and one of them is my great-grand sponsor, and I come from a long line of sponsorship, 53 years, 39 years, my sponsor has 24 years, I just follow the path they've laid out in front of me. What a blessing that's been for me. I've fallen into something that I never thought possible for a guy like me, and I get to drag people along with me along that path, and some of them are here today. One of them is here today. A couple of them is here today. We had a wonderful ride down here. There was some guys that come along with us, and we had a wonderful ride down here, and we talked about recovery, and we talked about the changes in our life. I'm going to tell you about 15 years ago, that wouldn't have been anywhere close to anything that I would have even cared to talk about, or you people wouldn't have been people that I would have cared to associate it with, because, see, I had found what the book says and the way you are now, the way you were then, maybe, but I had found what the book called Sordid Places and Lower Companions, and that's where I hung out, and that's the thing that I was doing, and I better get into this thing. The book says that we describe in a general way what we used to be like and what happened and what we are like now. And I can tell you that I come from two wonderful parents. I've got an older sister, a couple years older than I am, and I never let her forget it. And I've got a younger sister, a couple years younger than I am. And I come from a good family. I didn't know it growing up, but we were poor. That wasn't one of the deals that was very important to me when I was growing up. It became important later, but it wasn't important to me when I was a little kid. And I'm talking about the earliest that I can remember, somewhere around probably 4 or 5 or 6 years old. And within the confines of that family, I was okay, you know, and stuff at that those times. I didn't feel different, and I didn't feel less than or unique or anything like that, you know. And then some things started to happen, some things started to change. But at the earliest age that I can remember, I was okay within the confines of that family. And I can remember, you know, my mom and dad going to work every day. My dad, as I got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and I got into that book, I found out my dad was a hard drinker. My dad's story was that he drank a lot before he met my mom, and my mom said it's going to be the booze or her, and he chose her. You see, I don't understand that. But if given sufficient reason to quit, a hard or moderate drinker can quit and live successfully. And my dad lived successfully, but I believe he was a hard drinker. My mom's never had a drink of alcohol. In fact, when I was about 5 years sober, I was just kind of a little proud about that deal. And I just, at my anniversary, I kind of told her something about that. I said, Mom, today, you know, as of today, I said, I haven't had a drink in 5 years. And she said, well, that's really good. She paused for a minute, and I could see some things going on. She said, you know, I ain't had a drink in 68 years. And it all kind of made it a little insignificant, you know, because... she just wanted to be a part of, you know. But she just never, ever drank. Never found a need to drink. Was always, seemed to be okay within herself. I'm a product of the north side of Des Moines. I always like to say that I'm a wannabe tough guy, north side punk, because that's what I did, and that's what I was. I've pretty much been on the north side of Des Moines all my life. Made a couple geographics, not very far. I'm not very adventuresome, but made a few geographics. But I live right now exactly a mile from where I grew up, in a big old house on the corner. What I know about that, what I know about growing up where I did with the people that I did with, they did the absolute best they could with what they had to work with. They were good people. All our needs were met. They were provided for. I had a roof over my head, I had meals, and I had clothes on my back. And I was given the best that they could provide, you know. At about the age of 7 or 8, 9 or 10, somewhere around in there, I think probably more around 10 years old, maybe where my boy is now. I got Alyssa's here with us. She's our oldest, and then I got we have a son named Luke. He's 10, and Chelsea Ray, she's 7. She'll be 8 here soon, and they're absolutely God's gift to me, to us, they've all been really raised in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just think that's wonderful. But probably about the time 10 years old, maybe where Luke is now, is that I started to notice some things. I started to see some things. I started to be aware of the fact that, you know, that I didn't dress the way some of the other kids at school dressed. And I started to notice that we didn't drive the kind of cars that other people were driving. And I started to notice that, you know, my folks were a little bit square, you know, and my sisters were a little bit nerdy, you know, and stuff. And I just kind of thought maybe I didn't fit into that picture. What I need to report to you is it got worse. It never got better, you know. I thought they got square and my sisters got, you know, weirder and all that kind of stuff. And you know, that I was the only one in that family that seemed to, you know, why did it have to happen to me and all that stuff. You know, I was the only one that, and it was all about me, see. You know, as I was growing up there, I started to feel, this is when I started to feel kind of less than. I'd go to school and people say all the time up here, you hear it, I'm just like that, or just, I hope I'm just like that. I hope I'm just like you. That's what I want to be. I want to be, because if I'm not just like you and I don't fit here, I don't know where I go, But that thing started to happen to me, and I started to feel like that maybe I didn't quite measure up and that I was not enough. As I started to grow up a little bit more, I kind of felt like maybe I wasn't smart enough, and maybe I wasn't bright enough, and maybe I wasn't, good looking enough. Maybe I didn't have enough money. Maybe I wasn't, I started to get involved in athletics. Maybe I wasn't tough enough. Maybe I wasn't fast enough. Maybe my ability wasn't quite what other people's were, and so I've got all this stuff going on, and I go home and I got square folks and weird sisters, and I don't know what to do about all that stuff, and I start blaming them. I start blaming my folks. Well, if only you made a little more money, if only we lived on a different side of town, I start telling my sisters things like, leave me alone, get out of here. I don't like you, I don't want to be around you and stuff. I don't know where that came from. I it came from within, and we talk about that hole, and I've got that hole, I've got that big hole, and I need to fill that, and I'll fill that with power, prestige, money, praise, applause, anything I can, at this time. I don't know a lot about anything else at this time, but I'll fill it with all that stuff that I can, that hole's too big, there can't be enough of whatever, and somebody last night was talking about that there just can't be enough, And I got involved in athletics as I got a little older. I got involved in athletics, and through that athletics, I started to get some attention that I craved, and I started to get some awards and those types of things, but they were never enough, It was never enough, so I'm trying to win favor with people and do all that stuff, and it's just not enough for me, and I still feel like I'm not enough. I still feel less than. I still feel like I don't fit in. And I've got that going on at school, and by this time I went to school early on, and I had them god awful high water pants with those those hose socks and those black shoes, and I was butch, and I looked weird, and I probably acted weird, and I just never felt like I fit, but that was probably when I was in grade school. By the time I got to ninth grade and on into high school and stuff, I started hanging around with a bunch of guys, and because of athletics, I kind of got there, I got to hang out with them, and they were not necessarily the most popular guys, but they were the guys, they were the guys that wanted me to hang out with them, and it was Tony and Craig and Tom and Billy and David, and the thing that I always identify with when people talk about is that I never felt on the inside the way they looked on the outside. These guys always looked slick, hip, and cool. And I always felt like I was just a little bit behind, and stuff. And I never quite understood that. And I never felt just as good as they looked. And they always seemed to be on top of things. And I just seemed to be a step down. And I didn't seem to ever quite measure up to them, for some reason, they let me kind of hang out with them and go and do the things that they did. And I was just really happy about that, and stuff. And I have, I've got all these things going on. I'm scared. And I feel like I don't fit in. I've got that. I've got insecurities and all those kinds of things going on, and I've never taken a drink of alcohol yet. I'm 14, about 14 years old, and I've got all this stuff, and I really don't have a solution except for just to keep going and doing what I'm doing, And I don't have a solution. And one night we were going to, if you grew up on the north side of town over there, and I'm sure it was the same a lot of places, but on the north side of Des Moines over there, we were going to. I was in the ninth grade, and we were going to a party, and it was called a make-out party, and I was pretty excited about that. I hadn't really had a whole lot of experience with that at that time. And what they did back then is they put a little stack of 45s on a stereo, and everybody grabbed their girl, and the lights got low, and you kissed, and it was a make-out party. And I'd heard all about them. Never been to one yet, but I'd heard all about them, and I'd heard good things about him too, and stuff. And so I was really wanting to be a part of that, and I really wanted to go and do that. And we were going. It was me and a couple other guys, and it was on the. We were walking. We walked everywhere because we didn't have a car, and we were up at the Dunkin' Donuts at 4th and Euclid, and we'd met a buddy of mine up there, and Craig had stolen the bottle of a bottle of schnapps from his dad, and it was a pint, and he had it in his coat and stuff, and we were up there behind the Dunkin' Donuts, and he said, "Here," he said, "take a drink of this." He said, this will help us, you know. And Craig took a drink, and the other guy took a drink, and I took a drink. And, you know, I've never tasted anything like that before, and I can't remember who, Cliff or Taylor or somebody yesterday was talking. It's the exact same thing that happened. That stuff, it was hot, and it went down in the bottom of my stomach, and it was burned all the way down, and it got down there, and it turned around a couple, two or three different times, and then it started to come out to my fingers. My fingers got warm. My face got flushed. My ears got hot. My head felt like it was on fire, and they said, "You want another one?" I said, "You bet," you know. And I said, they give us another drink, and I had two drinks of that schnapps, and that was when I was 14 years old, and you know, something started to happen. You know, we stepped out of there. We left there, and I started stepping out a little easy. I started stepping out like, you know, I wasn't drunk, but my face was hot, my head was on fire, my ears were burning. My finger, you know, everything, I felt a little different. And I started to step out of there, and we had about five or six blocks to go and see we was going to this makeout party, and she was going to be there. And before I took those two drinks of schnapps, I wasn't quite sure how that was all going to happen. After I took those two drinks of schnapps and we started stepping out of there, I knew how it was going to happen. You know? I knew exactly how it was going to happen. And we got over there to that party, and it happened just the way. I had a wonderful time. And I hope she did too. We had a chance. I had my 25-year class reunion. My wife and I went, and we had a chance to go there, and I showed my wife that lady. You know, that was the first time I'd ever drank, and you know, I didn't pass out, black out, fall down, throw up, what's the bed or nothing. You know, I didn't do that, but I remembered what happened. You know, I didn't drink again for another year or so, and the next time I drank. All those things happened. You know, I got invited. You know, all these guys, Tom and Craig and Billy and Tom and Jeff, all of them. Man, they were going to a place called The Hill. And if you grew up on the north side of Des Moines, you knew where The Hill was. And you know what happened on The Hill. There was keggers happening. There was excitement that happened on The Hill. We'd have bonfires and we'd have kegs and they'd have parties. I like to say we because now I've been there. But before that time, I hadn't been there. I'd heard all about it. Couldn't wait to go. Was excited to get asked, and I got asked to go, you know. And I got asked to go on the weekend, and about Monday, I'm fired up. You know, my adrenaline's starting pumping. I'm going. We're not going until Friday, but Monday, I'm ready to go, you know. Tell me again what we're going to do. Tell me again what's going to happen, you know. And what it was they was going to make a trash can. They was going to take this cooler and just start pouring all this booze in there, see. And that sounded wonderful to me. I didn't have a clue what it was going to do to me, but it sounded wonderful. And see, all those guys are going to be there, and I want to be with those guys. And I remember what happened with those two shots of schnapps, how it just kind of made me step out a little easy. Maybe I felt a little bit like I belong. But I know if they're doing it, I want to do it, you know. And by this time, another year later, I've got more fear. I've got more insecurity. I've got a lot riding on this deal. My hole's gotten bigger. It takes more of all that stuff to fill it up, and it ain't working, you know. And so I go up on the hill there on that Friday night, they get a circle going, and what happens is they give everybody a little cup, and you go around in a circle, and you take a drink out of that cooler, you know. And I took my first drink, and the same type of thing went down. Turned around, this is a concoction of all kinds of stuff, and you turned around down there, and it come back up, and it got out to the fingers, got out to just exactly the same thing, and you just kept kind of walking around in that circle, you know, talking to guys and stuff, but nobody ever cut in line too much or nothing like that. It was just, you know, just kind of. Next guy up, and I think the object of the thing was to get as good and as drunk as you could, and that's what I did. You know, the last thing I remember about being up on the hill on that Friday night is I'm laying underneath that spigot. It's wide open, and I'm laying there I'm drinking that stuff for all that I can. You know, I want it all, and I'm laying underneath there. And that's the last thing I remember about being up on that hill Friday night. The next thing I remember about that Friday night is I come to. I had been in a blackout, and somebody yesterday talked about being in blackouts, and I didn't have a clue what they were until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was always the last thing I remember, and then people filled in the blanks. The next thing I remember about that night, though, was that I come to down at North High School in the softball field. I come to right out in left field there, and I'm walking. I'm crawling around on my hands and knees out there. And when I kind of get my senses about what's going on, you know, that's kind of goofy in itself, but they've got a softball game going on, you know, and I'm out there and I'm crawling around on my hands and knees. And I kind of look around, and there's the left fielder, and there's the center fielder, and my buddies are over hanging on the fence, you know, and they're kind of laughing at me and pointing at me. Something happened that night that was a continuing pattern for the next probably 14 years. Is that they come, and they pick me up, and they put me in the car, and they took me home, and they poured me out on the curb. And all those things that I talked about that didn't happen the first time I drank, they happened that night. Throwed up, I'd wet my pants, I'd blacked out. I was just an idiot. And I somehow got in the house. I used to think my sister got me in there, which she might have. But I'm not sure. But anyway, I come to Saturday morning, and I was a mess, and my head hurt so bad, you know. And I thought about all that time, and I thought, you know what? I don't know if I really want to do that again, but I can't wait till they ask me again. You know, that whole thing of being there and being with them and being a part of just enticed me, you know, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And I did it again and again and again and over and over and over. And one of the things that happened to me in all that process was that my older sister became a real important part of my drinking, I guess, because what she did for me was that every time they'd come home and pour me out, or I'd get home or something like that, she would pick me up, and she would bring me in the house, and she'd clean me up, and she'd put me to bed. And you know, if you come from a family that I come from, I got hearing people might have called that enabling, because my mom did a lot of the same type of thing. But I tell you, they loved me, and they just did the best they could. You know, they absolutely did the best they could, you know. See, we don't air our dirty laundry, and we take care of our troubles ourselves. And they're not airing me out there, because I'm the dirty laundry. And they think that if they love me enough, that if they help me enough, that if they just create this situation and it's good enough, that their little boy won't go out and get drunk and raise hell anymore. See, they don't know. And what I didn't know was that I suffered from alcoholism. And after I got here, what I didn't know is that what it's in the book, and we talk about it a lot, is that behind them is a world of ignorance and misunderstanding. They didn't have a clue that I suffered from the disease of alcoholism. I didn't have a clue, you know. And my life continued, you know. The disease progressed, and my alcoholism progressed. I got a little lucky, and I got to go down and play ball at a place called Central College in Pella, Iowa. I went down there to play football and drink. And that's exactly what I did. I drank enough to get asked to leave there. That Dutch community down there, where's my friend? There she is. She's from Pella and understands that. They're just not too keen on drinking, that Dutch reform down there. There's a couple things that they really are aware of. They love tulips, and they didn't, you know, they didn't like people messing with their tulips. I'll just tell you this story, and then we'll leave Central. we used to close the bars down, and what would happen is we'd get to driving on campus down there, that was one of my favorite sports, is to get drunk and drive down around there. And it was good. They kind of had some stuff, and you had to dodge in and out of them. One day, they come a knock on my dorm room door, the dean was there, and he said, "John," he said, "can you come with us?" And I said, "Sure." We got out there, and we got to looking around, and there was tire tracks all over. And he said, "John," he said, "can you explain any of this to me?" And I said, "No, Dean, I can't." He said, "Okay." And we went over, and we looked at a bed of tulips, and it was just destroyed. And he said, "John," he said, "can you explain this to me?" And I said, "No, Dean," I said, "I can't." We went over and we looked at a set of tire prints that was going back to the parking lot. I'm thinking, man, this guy, he's way out there. You know, he's going to try and pin all this on me and da-da-da-da-da. And he says, "Are those your tire tracks?" And I said, "No, Dean, they're not." You know, we went around and we found my car. And he says, "Is this your car?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you want to come here?" And on the front bumper of my car was about 27 tulips. I couldn't deny it anymore, you know. I mean, what I wanted to tell him was that somebody stole my car and did that, you know. I got, because of, not necessarily because of that, but because of my drinking, I got asked to leave there. I had an opportunity. See, I've had wonderful opportunities and wonderful teachers my whole life, and most of the time I screwed them up, and this time I didn't. There was a guy named Skipper, and he'd come down, and he talked to me in Des Moines, and he asked me if I wanted to come back and play one more year down there, or two more years, and I said yes, I'd like to. And he said this, and this was going to be something that I was going to hear until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, John, we'd love to have you back, but you got to do something about your drinking. And I said, okay, Skip, I can do that. And I had a lot of resolve to change a lot of things in my life, and I had a lot of resolve to do something about my drinking, and I didn't know that I couldn't. I didn't know that I suffered from a disease, you know, an obsession and an allergy. I didn't know that thing. You know, I thought if I just tried a little harder, created a different situation, turned over a new leaf, that I could do something about my drinking, that I could control, you know. And I got down there and I got in more trouble, you know, but I was able to get out of there, and I had a wonderful opportunity, and I had some real good teachers down there to be able to learn some things, and I just blew all that. I didn't pay attention, and I didn't learn much down there, you know, and stuff. So I come home, and I married my high school sweetheart, and we got married, and she had 1 year of school left, and we got married, and she's a great lady, you know, what I know about her today that maybe she knew was that she couldn't change me. She, here's another person that said, John, you got to do something about your drinking, you know, and that marriage didn't last very long. It lasted about 2 years, and she says, I'm out of here. And you know what I got to tell you about that is that if I would have been married to me at that time, I would have been out of here. See, my disease had progressed now where I'd say, yeah, I'll be home after work and we'll go do that, you know. And what happened was that I'd stop and have a couple drinks with the guy. And you know, I didn't know about the allergy, and I didn't know, but once I took a couple drinks into my system, then my system wants more alcohol, and that I'm going to stay there and I'm going to drink, you know. And I didn't know that when I told her that I'm going to come home and we'll do that stuff, that she really believed that I was going to come home and do that stuff. You know, I had every intention to do that stuff, but I'd stop there and things started happening then, you know, and stuff. And so, you know, I by this time I'm staying out, I'm closing the bars down, staying out, and just not being responsible, not doing the right thing. And a couple of years of that, and she said, I've had enough, and out she went, you know. And I've lost my education, and I've lost my wife, and because of you know, alcoholism, I lost a house, I lost all that stuff, you know. And I'm progressing here real rapidly now. In the last few years of my drinking, I'm drinking every day. I'm drinking every morning. I used to keep a half gallon of gin in the back of my truck, and I'd stop and get a little 7-Up and pour most of it out and fill it up with gin, and I'd drink that on the way to work. And there was a bar that opened at 9 o'clock, and I'd stop there and have a couple red beers, stop back in there at lunch and have a couple about 3 o'clock. And then when I got off work, I'd sit there until however long I needed to sit there, you know. And I did that over and over and over again, you know. And you know what happened to me was that I'd lost all resolve by this time to ever do anything, you know. I used to think that I would, you know, try and like to do something about that and have some resolve and maybe change my life. But I'd lost that resolve in the last couple of years of my drinking. I just, you know, I was drinking to live and living to drink, and that was it. You know, it was the same thing over and over and over again. And I didn't know if I could do anything about that. By this time now, I'm kind of a no-show at home and a no-show with the people that love me. And by this time now, all those guys that were a part of my life are out of my life, and they don't. They can't be around me anymore. You know, they love to tell a story. You know, we would get together once in a while, and when I'd go to the bathroom, they'd all leave. You know, and I'd come out of the bathroom, because they couldn't stay with me anymore because I was just trouble. I didn't want to stay out all night, and I wanted to drink hard, and I wanted to fight hard, and I wanted to play hard. And when I'd get up and go to the bathroom, and you think I'd learn, you know, you think, but I always had, you know, I guess had hope because they did that more than once, you know. I had an opportunity to be with them guys a few times and sober. And they were drinking, and, you know, and we'd go out to eat, and they'd have a few drinks, and they'd say to me, John, you sure were a lot more fun when you were drinking. And you know what I said? I said, guys, you were a lot more fun when I was drinking too, you know. Because I didn't care to sit around there and watch them get drunk, you know. And none of them are alcoholic, in my opinion. They've never asked me, but but they all, you know, they all have, they just seem to be responsible in what they do. And I, if they are alcoholic, that's for them anyway. But, you know, I see them not having a problem with that. But I don't get to see them much anymore, you know, and I don't get to be a part of their life. And when I do, it's okay, you know, and stuff. My drinking got to a point where I was becoming physically harmed. I had something in the nervous system. My back hurt all the time, and by this time too, I'm doing drugs and something to enable or enhance, you know, my drinking. My drinking is the drug of my choice, you know, and it's the thing that I love to do. But anything that can help me drink the way I want to drink, I'll take, you know. And people, you know, I did a lot of that stuff, you know, and it's all about being addicted, I think, you know. But I know that for me, if given a choice, that I just love to drink, and I love to drink hard and fast and as much as I could whenever I could, you know, and stuff. And what was happening was this thing was winding down, and I'd lost everything by this time, and I didn't have a place to go. And one more time, I asked my folks if I could come back home. I didn't have a place to stay, and they always kind of had a rule by this time because of the things that I've done, that I couldn't come home and be drinking, you know, and I couldn't be there drunk. And, you know, I didn't have any resolve anymore. I didn't say, well, that'll, I just said, okay, you know. And I knew that if I was drinking that I couldn't be there, but I didn't have any place to go. I lived quite a bit of my time at that time in a GMC pickup truck, you know, and I had a bumper sticker that said, I'm looking for a cola-loving woman, you know. I had a no floorboard in the driver's side, and some guys that were around. I brought that truck into sobriety, you know, and it was a gem, you know. But I had a toolbox on the back of that, and I always had to change two or three chains of clothes and a half gallon of gin back there, and me and my truck went about everywhere, you know. But I moved what I had over to my folks' place, by this time, my dad was always handicapped and he was in a wheelchair for the last probably 20 years of his life, and he was real sick at this time, and this is in 1985, he was real sick, he had been on kidney dialysis for a couple years, he was really dying, but he went down with some grace and dignity. But anyway, we moved in there, and here I am. I'm a wreck, you know. I'm 275 pounds of disgust, you know, and I come back into their world. And my dad a lot of times would have to sit up at nights because he couldn't sleep, and so he'd sit up in this big recliner he got in, and I'd come in there some nights drunk, and he couldn't throw me out, and he really quit asking me to leave. And a couple nights I'd sit down there and I'd talk to him, and he said, John, what do you, you know, you got to do something about your drinking. Here's more people telling me, John, you got to do something about your drinking. And I'd say, yeah, Dad, I know, but I don't know what to do. And for the first time, my dad gave me a little bit of a solution. He said, well, you want to talk to Ralph. And Ralph was a guy that had grown up across the street from us, and Ralph was in AA. And I knew Ralph was a drunk because as a kid, I can remember looking out the window at night watching Ralph trying to make up a little hill about this high. And Ralph would try and get up, and he'd get up about halfway that hill, and down he'd go, and he'd get back up, and he'd try that, and I'd just laugh. I'd sit in the window and laugh, you know. And this is late at night. But anyway, my dad said, John, do you want to go and talk to Ralph? And I said, no, Dad. Now, I don't want to go talk to anybody about my drinking, you know, and stuff. So I told him was it didn't have anything to do with my drinking, is what I told him. He didn't have much to say, and so as things kind of progressed and stuff, I got to a point where I'm not working much now. I've got a job, and I go there, but I'm not doing much work, and I don't go as early as I need to, and I don't stay kind of as long as I need to, and a lot of times every day I go out for lunch, and it just depends who's at the bar, whether I come back or not, and those types of things. My boss is getting real skeptical of all this, but I've got my boss over a barrel. My boss has been doing some things that aren't quite legal, and I know about them. So if he leaves me alone, I'm gonna leave him alone. You know, it's just whatever I can do to live the way that I want to do. And so I was afforded that luxury of drinking all the time, anytime that I wanted. He never took that He never took that risk or that chance to say, you got to go, you know. So, but he was another one that said, you know, maybe you ought to do something about your drinking. So I've had all these people all my life that said, John, you need to do something about your drinking. And not one of them, really, that I remember, I'd been to psychiatrists and counselors and those types of things, ever give me a solution on what to do about my drinking. It's coming down to the spring of 1986, and by this time there's a guy that, one of these guys that that I grew up with has been kind of introduced back into my life, and he's not really one of the kind of one of the good guys. He's a guy like me, you know, and stuff, and we did a lot of drinking, a lot of fighting, and a lot of playing, you know, together and stuff, and Mark called me one day, and he said he was looking for a job, and I passed the word on to my boss, and I'm thinking, yeah, you know, this is great. Here's a drunk just like me, you know, somebody that can drink like me and that can have fun like me. See, I'm still in the mode of, you know, let's do this thing and let's do it right, you know, and stuff. And so Mark got hired on there, and what I didn't know, I knew Mark had had a couple, he'd had trouble drinking once or twice, but what I didn't know was Mark was sober. And I get to work, and I asked Mark, I said, Mark, do you want to go out and get something to drink? And he said, John, I don't drink anymore. You know, my heart fell. What do you mean you don't drink anymore? And he told me, he said, I don't drink anymore. He didn't say anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't say anything about having a spiritual awakening or anything. Working the steps, didn't throw a big book on the dash of my car or nothing. He just said, I don't drink anymore. But what he did for the next 6 months of us working together was that he was a living testament or example of he was an attraction to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was about best 12 steps I've ever seen, and it was done on me. Because this guy was just like me our whole life, and he wasn't like me anymore. He'd come to work every morning, he's whistling, he's happy, he's trying to be of service to people. I know that now. I hated him then. You know, I thought, guys, you know, I'm dying from within, and you know, I've got that big hole, and I can't fill it with enough of anything anymore, you know, and now it's what alcohol's done to me. I've got isolated from my family, I've got isolated from my friends, you know, I'm full of fear, loneliness, you know, I'm desperate, I don't know what to do, you know, well, Mark was drinking, he said, I can take you a place, and he says, we'll sit around and talk about your drinking, and not drinking, and I said, okay, thanks, Mark, thanks for the information, you know, so, and I went on about my way. But I remembered that. You know, I don't know what time, when that happened, but I remembered that because there come a day. It was April 4th of 1986. And April 3rd of 1986, I'd been in a place called the Jim Dandy, and it's down at 6th in New York, and it's a world-class joint. It's not even open anymore. But my friend Bobby Mack and I used to, I think, we were probably there together at the same time. But that's where I started my last drunk, and I believe that's where he started one of his last. It was a world-class joint. It was my type of place. I've never been thrown out of there, number one, so I felt real good going there all the time, you know. And there was people there at 5 o'clock in the morning, and there was people there at 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, a lot of mornings on the way to work, I'd stop in there and have one with George. You know, at night, I'd come there. But this night, April 3rd of 1986, I was on about a 2 or 3 day run, you know, and I hadn't been to work for a couple of days. I ended up down at the Jim Dandy, and we started in, and we closed that place down, and we grabbed some beer, and we went over to the bartender's house, I've been in a lot worse situations. I've been in a lot tighter jams, and I've been in serious trouble with the law or that type of thing. But one of the things that happened to me that night, and that had never happened to me before, is I never felt the way that I felt that night. You know, I didn't have any place else to go. I didn't know what to do, you know. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired, and didn't know that either, you know, and stuff. And so along about 4 o'clock in the morning, the guy says, John, you got to go. And I said, you know, how do you tell him? I don't have any place to go. I'm scared to leave there. I'm scared to stay there. You know, I'm scared that if I go out of there and try and go home, that I don't know what's going to happen to me. And I've never felt like that before, you know. And I believe, you know, that I've got all that fear going on, and I'm just lonely, and I'm scared to death, and you know, I became desperate that night. I left there, and I grabbed a couple beers, and went up, and I hid out at a place called Park Fair, which is not very far from where I live, behind the little mall there. And I kind of come to, and The garbage truck scared me to death, and I don't know if it scared me worse than I scared him or not. I popped up out of that truck, and God, I must have been looking good, you know. But anyway, I come to, and I didn't know what to do. For the first time in my life, I was absolutely without answers, and I was absolutely scared to death. What I remembered was Mark said, if you ever want to do anything about your drinking, give him a call. I really did. I really did want to do something. So I made my way over to the payphone, and I called my mom, and I lived 3 blocks in there, and I said, Mom, I said, I got to come home. And she goes, well, come on home. And I said, but I've been drinking. Now, they didn't want me there drunk, but I'd been doing it forever. But for that, some reason, that day it meant something. And I said, but I've been drinking. And she said, come on home anyway. One more time, she loved me and did the best she could. And so I went home, and as I'm pulling out of the parking lot there, you know, I'm sick and tired, and I'm scared, and I'm lonely, and I'm desperate, and I want to do something about my drinking. And as I'm pulling out of the parking lot of Park Fair, one of those beers rolls out from underneath the seat. And I got 3 blocks to go, and I've told her I want to do something about my drinking, and I'm scared, and yet for some reason or another, and I know it today, it's alcoholism, and it's that allergy. I could not drink that beer. I opened that beer and drank that beer between Park Fair and my mom's house 3 blocks away. I walk in the house there, and I walk, as I've done many times, I walk straight through there. Bob was talking about the look. I got the look. I got the look from my dad, and I've had that look. I got the look from my mom, and I've had the look from many people. But that day it meant something. That day it absolutely tore me up, you know. And I knew for the first time in my life that, you know, that I was without answers, and I didn't know what to do. I go back to the back of the bedroom, and I just curl up in a ball in the fetal position. I've been on about a 3-dayer, and I ain't looking good, I ain't smelling good, and I ain't feeling well. My mom comes back, and she says, what can we do? What do you want to do? And I said, well, I'm going to call Mark. And she goes, I think that's a good idea. And I called Mark, and I said, Mark, what are you doing? And he said, I'm at work. Where are you? And I said, Mark, I think I want to do something about my drinking. I said, if you got some time later today or something, I said, would you come over and talk to me? And he said, I'll be right there. And I said, well, you don't have to leave work to do it. He said, I'll be right there. 15 minutes later, Mark came over there. And Mark shared with me a little bit about about not drinking. And then he asked me a question. He says, do you want to do something about your drinking? Are you willing to go to a meeting? And I said, yes. And he asked me that again, and I said, yes. And he said, I'll be there at 7 o'clock tonight to pick you up. And I said, okay. And he walked out of there, and I passed out or laid down or something and fell asleep. And when I come to, you know, probably about 6 o'clock, I got up, and I took a shower, and I got to thinking, you know. It's an amazing thing we got. I got to think maybe I overcorrected a little bit. You know. Maybe if I could just get down to the gym, Dandy. Maybe if I could get over to the North Star or someplace like that, get with my peer group, that everything was going to be okay. You know, I just maybe had made a bad decision. So anyway, Mark's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he does what he says he's going to do. But what he did that night was he showed up a little bit early. We went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. We went on a Friday night. And I love to tell that story because I really didn't have any other place to go, you know. Because if you're new and you come to a meeting on a Friday night, you know, there's not too many tourists that go to Alcoholics Anonymous on a Friday night. You know, any night, actually. But anyway, I went down to a meeting in Indianola, Iowa at a Catholic church, and I knew right from the minute we got there that the gig was over, you know. And I walk in there, and they start talking about a God, and they start talking about, you know, turning your life and this over. This is all afterwards. I don't remember really anything that they said at my very first meeting. I remember a couple people that were there, but I remember at the end of the meeting, they told me to keep coming back. It had been a long time since a guy like me had been asked to come back anywhere, you know. I had a kind of a little reputation going, and it wasn't good. And like I said, Jim Dandy was the only place that I could drink comfortably in the way I wanted to drink without scare of being thrown out. And they said keep coming back. We did the meeting after the meeting, and I went to that. I'm dying on the inside to feel a part of something, yet on the outside I've got these things these fences up, and you know, and I don't let you get near me, and I'm real nice and polite, and I say, mm-hmm, yes, but on the inside, you know, I'm just really dying to be a part of what you have, you know, and stuff. And so I go to a meeting. Mark took me to a lot of meetings. We went to a meeting Saturday night and Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, and you know, I started on this venture, and I'm contempt prior to investigation. Still am a little bit today, you know, but we started talking about the steps and started talking about God. And when you mentioned God, I shut down. You know, I come to AA real closed-minded, just real dishonest and real unwilling. But I'm here, you know, and you can, and the magic can start working. And see, when you start talking about God, I got old ideas. I was raised in that Baptist church on the east side of Des Moines, and you know, I went down and gave my heart and soul to God at the age of 12 years old. At one of them revival things, you know, and the guy had made his pitch, and I felt bad, and I wasn't so worried about, you know, he said, if you're doing all these things, you're going to go to hell. And he said, if you're thinking about doing all these things, you're going to go to hell. Well, at 12 years old, I hadn't done a lot of those things, but I'd sure thought about doing a lot of them, and I couldn't wait to do a lot of them. And so, you know, I went down because my sister went down, and we give ourselves to Christ, you know, and that didn't work. You know, I'd been dipped, dunked, splattered, and splashed, and I was still, you know, I'm still a full-blown alcoholic. So anyway, you know, my old ideas about God was that he'd work for you, but he wouldn't work for me, you know. And I quit praying that foxhole prayer that if you get me out of this one, you know, I won't. I just quit doing that, you know, and stuff. And so I had a whole bunch of old ideas about that stuff, and people really brought me along with that stuff. An old guy... I had a safe place to go. I was going in and out of the White House a lot, going to meetings and stuff, and they told me if you don't have anything, do it here because it's a safe place. And I spent a lot of time drinking, and I had a lot of free time when I quit drinking. And so I was hanging out there, and I'm talking to this guy and about God and about all this, and you know, he said, if God drives you out of here, whiskey will drive your ass right back in here, you know, and stuff. And they kind of did things real simple like that for me, you know, and told me the truth. And I started going to meetings over there and at different places and stuff. I couldn't open up, you know. I'd walk into those places and I had a look on me, you know. It was kind of like stay away, you know, and stuff. And people went through that. People went through that, you know, and stuff. And kept holding out their hands and talking to me and asking me, you know, how I'm doing and those types of things. And I was going to a lot of meetings. I was going to a place called Fleur and Grand every day at noon, and there's some people here that did that. When Bob got sober, we were going down there, and it was just, it was wonderful. We had a good group of guys and some women, too, that were going to those meetings and coming to other meetings and stuff. I don't know what would have happened if it wouldn't have been for places like that and people like that. You know, there was some real instrumental people, you know, I got a sponsor, because they said you need a sponsor. Now I've been involved with athletics all my life, and I knew what a sponsor was, that he was going to help you get some new clothes. He was going to pay his way for you to get into tournaments and those types of things. And I equated that with, well, if I needed a few bucks here and there, maybe to tide me over for this, my sponsor's going to do that for me. You know? I don't know any different, and I'm not asking anybody any different. I'm not asking what does a sponsor do or anything like that, but I got a real awakening, you know, and it wasn't that at all. But I got a sponsor, and that sponsor worked with me through the first three steps and really through the inventory process, but through the first three steps a ton. And he worked with me and my relationship on God, and I struggled with that. I got another sponsor for a while, and I've had my current sponsor for about 11 years, he's just a tough old East Side guy. Just like I'm a tough old North Side guy wannabe, you know, and stuff. But anyway, I started working those steps, and I started to form a little bit of a relationship with God. You know, I got here, and it wasn't too hard to admit that I was an alcoholic. The powerlessness wasn't anything. The unmanageability was something that I'd struggle with and still sometimes do today. But anyway, we worked on that, and we worked on really coming to believe that some type of power could help me. And see what the logic was, and the thing that he explained to me was that if it's working for a room full of people like you, why don't I think it's going to work for me? You know, and I had to quit that debate, and so I did, and I started to form a relationship with God. All I really wanted God to do was to help me not drink. That's all I really wanted. just not drink, you know. And if he'd do that, then the rest of my life would be okay, you know, and stuff. And that was where I focused on that, on God. I started to get involved. I started to go to a lot of different meetings and stuff. You know, what I noticed was that I was without a partner. I didn't have anybody in my life, you know. So I started to look around. I'm thinking maybe I need to start dating now. I'm all of about 3 months sober, you know, and stuff. I'm thinking this would be a good thing. And I don't ask anybody what they think about that. I don't do anything. And so by coincidence or God's luck or whatever, I met my present wife, and her sister is married to my cousin, and they introduced us, and we got together, and we started dating, and it should have never worked. It really shouldn't have, but it did. And I thank God for that every day. We started a relationship, and I don't know how to do relationships well, and I started out that one on a lie, you know, I had to make amends later, and we started to date and stuff, and we were going to get married, and I'm not a year sober, and God intervened in our life, and I asked her to marry me. I think I was 6 months sober, and I asked her to marry me, and she wanted to get married in the Catholic Church, and there was something called an annulment process, and that took about a year, and so I got real busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I told her off the get-go that I needed to go to a lot of meetings, that I was an alcoholic, and that was okay with her, you know, and stuff, she got into Al-Anon, she got into the program of Al-Anon, and I'm not going to tell her story, but some situations and some things happened, and she found herself in Alcoholics Anonymous, and God, I love, you know, I love the fact that recovery is in our house, I love the fact that the program's in our house, and out of that union and stuff, three kids came, and Alyssa, Sissy's here with us, and Luke and Chelsea, and a couple years ago, I've got a great life, and a couple years ago, we were all hanging out around there, and we were doing something, and I could hear the kids in the dining room, and they were talking about who sponsors who, you know, and I think Sissy straightened them all out that Kim sponsors Sheila, my wife, and that Big Daddy Keith sponsors me, and one of the other two said, "Who sponsors us?" You know. And they just know all about that stuff. You know, they know about sponsorship. They know about the Alcoholics Anonymous. They know, gosh, I'll say so-and-so's coming over, somebody will say, well, what step's he on, you know, and stuff. And they've just really grown up in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm here. What I want to tell you about all that is I got a great life, but it never should have worked. I wasn't asking directions. I wasn't asking what I should do. I wasn't doing that. I was running the show myself, and for some reason or another, you know, God blessed us, and it worked. And you know, I got real busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was going to a ton of meetings, and people, there must have been, I bet 50 people asked me to sponsor them in the first couple, 2 or 3 years I was sober. And, you know, I said yes to every one of them, and there were some real winners there, you know, and stuff. And what I need to tell you about that was I don't sponsor one of those guys today. And I don't know if a whole lot of them are sober today, but I'm sober today, and I'm just so grateful for that. And it was, you know, I said yes, and I said come on, let's do this thing, come do what we do, you know. I got real busy in service and those types of things, and our life was just going on just great guns, you know, and stuff. And I got busy working the steps. I got a sponsor that took me through the steps, and I got busy with that inventory, and I found out my causes and conditions, and I found out what part I played, and I found out for the first time that it's not you, and it's not them, and it's not her, and it's not it, it's me, you know. And somebody last night said that, and I've met the enemy, and he is me, you know. And I find out that, you know, because of all those character defects, because of all that fear and that insecurity and that greed and that selfishness and that self-centeredness, you know, that I need to change. I need to change, and I don't know how to do that. So the God that I depended on, just that I wanted to help keep me sober, I needed to get a bigger God in my life. I needed to ask God to help me to change. I needed to ask God to help me to be willing to do the things to act different, just to do the things that would create the change in my life, you know, and stuff. And it's all about control. And I stand up here and tell you that tonight, but today, but the last year, my sponsor's been on me all about control. You know, I'm back taking control of some things in my life and stuff. And so I need to let go. He says, it's just like that fist. And he says, you just need to quit. You need to loosen the grip a little bit and let go. And, you know, I'm still sometimes just like that. And, you know, I'm trying. And I started to sponsor some guys, and some amazing things have happened from that, you know, and some amazing relationships have happened, and they help keep me accountable, and they help keep me busy. And my life today is absolutely wonderful, but it's very busy, and I love it, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, and I got a wonderful life, and the guys that I sponsor, I just tell them this. I said it's all about what my sponsor told me. It's all about getting rid of an old idea, you know, and the old idea that he told me that I had, he said, is that your way, it's not working now, it never worked in the past, and it ain't going to work in the future. He said, so come try it another way, and come try it our way, and come try it the program of Alcoholics Anonymous way. And my dependence has got to be upon God, but I'm so grateful that I've got people in my life that help show me the way. My friend Kimmy back there is just a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being with her, and my friend Bobby, and other people, you know, some people in this room, but I hope that I continue to stand with them on the firing line of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that I continue to reach my hand out for the newcomer because somebody reached their hand out for me. You know? I hope that I keep, as Cliff said, this thing simple and not watered down. You know, the problem is still the same. The problem is powerlessness. The problem is allergy and obsession. And we find that in the book, and the solution is still the same. The solution is for me to find a power that can solve my problem. And how I do that is I take steps 3 through 12 and take the necessary action for that to happen. The problem is still the same as it was in 39, and the solution is still the same as it was in 39. And I need to remember that, you know. And I need to continue to reach out my hand and to be of service and know that my great-grand sponsor says the brightest and future stars of AA aren't here yet. You know? And I need to be there. I'm just really grateful that I'm able to do that. I'm grateful for my home group. It's a Three Legacies group, and we meet every Monday night. And what a blessing that's been in my life. I'm grateful that people have showed me how to be of service there, how to get involved, how to stay involved, you know. And every Monday night that I'm in town, I'm there, you know. And my wife helps with that, and I thank her for that. That's my home group, and I'm really fired up about that home group. You know, I'm gonna wind down here real quick, but there's just a couple things I want to leave with you. And one is that there's a lady whom I admire a lot that says, "To those to whom much has been given, much is expected." And I've been given more than I ever thought possible. I'm just so grateful that I got God's grace instead of God's justice. I'm just so grateful for that. And then the last thing I want to tell you about is, and it'll be quick, but February 6th of this year, I couldn't get up. I couldn't get out of bed. And I called my wife. I said, "Sheila, come here. Something's wrong." And I couldn't make it. I've been laying there thinking about some things for a while, and I thought, see, I got this mind that self-diagnoses, self-prescribes, and then I self-destruct is what I do. But anyway, I was laying there, and I was actually on the couch because I'd moved out on the couch, and I couldn't move, and I'm thinking, if I can just get up. It was a Monday morning, it was February 6th, and I thought if I could just get up and get down and get a shower and get my clothes on, I can get out the door and things are going to be okay. And I couldn't get up. And I called my wife and I said, "Something's wrong here." I said, "I've really got a lot of pain and I don't know what that's all about." So she called work, said he's not coming in today. She got the medical book out and we kind of looked at some things and thought maybe that my appendix had ruptured, my appendix needed to come out. I had pain in my appendix or whatever, and Anyway, that didn't all matter to me. All I knew that I was in a lot of pain and stuff. And so we made our way. My sister came over, and we made our way out to the car, and we got down to the emergency room, and they poked and they prodded on me in for about 3 or 4 hours, and they, I just thought a couple times that if he touches me one more time, it's old behavior, but I'm gonna hit him. I was in a lot of pain, and what it ended up being, and I'll make this, is my appendix had ruptured. My appendix had ruptured 5 or 6 days prior to the day that I went to the hospital, and the doctor said that, you know, that I shouldn't really be here. And he told me a couple other things, and he said that we bury tough guys all the time, and some other things. But anyway, the point of all this is not that. The point of all this is that for the next 8 days that I was in the hospital and the 3 weeks after that, it's really hard for me. There were people there all the time. Kim's my wife's sponsor, and she was there, and my sponsor was there, and my sponsor's sponsor, and Bobby and Jason and Alex and Steve and all those guys were there, and the women, they cooked meals, and I was pretty out of it for 8 days, and I was in the hospital, and there was people that come up to see me all the time, and they helped my wife, and they helped my kids. They took my kids wherever they needed to go, and whatever they needed to do, and the nurse would come in and say, "Man, who are all those people?" And I felt really good to say they're friends of mine, you know, and stuff. And I got out of there, and we went home, and the ladies in the line of sponsorship, my wife, and they cooked meals for us, did those types of things. Where I'm going with all this is that 15 years ago, I lived in a 1974 GMC pickup truck. And I didn't have any friends. I'm dying to have some friends, and I didn't have any. When we read to watch loneliness vanish, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. For frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is a bright spot in our lives. That really means something for me. There's an old guy come through the White House sometime long time ago, and everything I've got's either begged, borrowed, or stole. I'm not original, and he said this, and I'm going to close with this. He says, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't promise to open the gates of heaven and let you in, but it'll sure open the gates of hell and let you out. And thank you for my life. Yay!